Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in American Studies. I'm your host, Michael Amico, and today we'll be talking with Rebecca Frazier. Her new book, just out from St. Martin's Press, is called The Mayflower, The Families, The Voyage, and the Founding of America. And it tells the story of the Plymouth Colony by focusing on the adventures and trials of Edward Winslow, who sailed over on the Mayflower in 1620, and then it picks up the story with his son, Josiah, who played a crucial role in the growing wars with the American Indians in the late 1670s. Rebecca Frazier is a writer, journalist, and broadcaster whose work has been published in Tatler, Vogue, The Times, and The Spectator. President of the Bronte Society for many years, she has written the introductions to the Everyman editions of Charlotte Bronte's novels Shirley and The Professor. Her books include The Story of Britain, a single-volume history of how England was governed during the past 2,000 years, and a biography of Charlotte Bronte, which examines her life in the context of contemporary attitudes to women. Rebecca Frazier, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Let's start with the question I always begin with, which is that this story, particularly the Mayflower, has been told and that the founding of the Plymouth Colony has been told again and again, surely for different purposes and different audiences. So why another telling and why now?
Well, it took a very long time to write. So why now is sort of irrelevant, really.
Why in the last 10 years?
I suppose that I've always been very fascinated by American history. Also, having written a book about British history, the story of Britain, which was really about waves of immigration into England and then their sort of adaptation, I was passing where John Winthrop came from near Aldborough in Suffolk, and someone said, "Oh, that's Groton, where John Winthrop used to worship." And I suddenly thought, what about doing things about something about people who didn't like this country, who left? And many years ago, I'd read John Demos's book, A Little Commonwealth, Family Life in Plymouth Colony. And it sort of evolved from there. They were the first people over. They were Puritans, but they were different from Massachusetts. And also, I was very intrigued because many years ago, I'd actually seen the three portraits of the Winslows in Pilgrim Hall Museum. And I'd been sort of surprised that they looked like portraits of people at the court of Charles I. I mean, they didn't really look like Puritans. They were grandly dressed. There was gold on the two men's neckties. The lady looked as if she could be a friend of Queen Henrietta Maria. And I thought, I'd always sort of wondered, what were these portraits doing in Plymouth Colony, which, was sort of thought to be poor, etc. And so it was always at the back of my mind. And then, having done a book about Britain, as I said, and thinking about people leaving, someone said to me, "Oh, well, Edward Winslow has never really been covered, but here's the person who really wrote a lot of the accounts of the colony separate to William Bradford." And then someone else said, "Oh, well, in fact, the reason those portraits were painted was that he came back to work for Cromwell." So there was an English angle, because, of course, from the American point of view, it's been told again and again and again. But this is a sort of coming at it from a British angle, thinking, what was it like? Why did he return? We think of the Mayflower as a voyage in which everyone stays put, and it's sort of, it's one of America's great foundation myths. It's the beginning of everything, in a way, you could argue. And yet, what's he doing back here? And then that led to a lot of exploration. Then I discovered that one in four New Englanders returned at the time of the Civil War. And so it all sort of it came English, from there. So it,
right.
English, sorry, the yeah. English Civil War. And so it kind of rolled from there. And I had these ideas about America, sort of liberty, freedom, which of course were anachronistic, because of course what's enunciated in the 18th century is very different from religious separatists in the 17th century. But I didn't know all of these things. And in fact, Plymouth, because of this book by John Demos, is very much, you know, was a very, very special place. And they retained a sort of independence of mind so that they allowed Quakers to live in Plymouth, whereas, of course, they were hanged in Boston.
Right.
And so I was sort of intrigued by them as a sort of as a small group. And that's really where it started. And of course, being ignorant, I didn't really realize this is what the hallowed ground this was. But, you know, it's following one unknown family, and then there are lots of sort of links to England. So it makes it more transatlantic. And I think there's quite there is a lot of new material which came from our National Archives, but in London, but that also links up with material which is in the Massachusetts Historical Society in their collections. They have sort of boxes of Winslow papers.
Right. So, and I want to come back to the actually John Demos's book, A Little Commonwealth,
yeah.
And also the tolerance that was present in Plymouth, particularly in Plymouth Colony at the time compared to
yeah.
Massachusetts Bay Colony. But let's just pause on Edward Winslow as a character for you. And I'm wondering, why hasn't he been taken up as a through line for this story? I mean, the way you write the story, Edward is the real fire starter pioneer here. He has a kind of energy that feels very different, at least, you know, as the way you present it, than some of the other early colonists. And so it is sort of curious that he hasn't gotten the attention in the tellings as much as, say, William Bradford as the author of Plymouth Plantation, and then some of the other later colonists in the 18th century. But then also this more attention gone to Massachusetts Bay and John Winthrop and those kinds of people. So can you talk a little bit about maybe why Edward has been the focus, and what's the difference that Edward brings compared to those others?
Well, I think that, first of all, Longfellow was descended from two pilgrims. In fact, he was probably descended from more, but he was descended from Priscilla Mullins and John Alton. So he writes The Courtship of Miles Standish. And after the American Revolutionary Wars, American writers are creating new...
So people know Longfellow is Henry David Longfellow?
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who's writing much later. And
much later, but he's writing, he's creating, along with other 19th century writers, a new literature for the new republic. And so he writes about Miles Standish, Priscilla Mullins, and John Alden. So they become incredibly famous. And he didn't write about Edward Winslow. So the pilgrims everyone knows about are those three. And of course, they know about William Bradford because he wrote this sort of jewel of 17th century American literature of Plymouth Plantation. But Edward was kind of like an engine man. I mean, he was the engine, if you like, but he's been cast into shadow by that. And then, of course, as I say, he vanishes in 1646 on a mission for the whole of New England to Parliament in Old England to stop them interfering in New England. And so he's out of the story. And in fact, William Bradford was furious. And the last four lines of Plymouth Plantation are, Edward Winslow has gone without our permission, sort of, and this pillar of our sort of colony has vanished, and this is very distressing for us. So again, there was a sort of a mystery for me, you know, why wasn't more known? Of course, there are Edward Winslow devotees like Cynthia Crusell, who runs the Winslow House in Marshfield. But he is less known. I mean, he's becoming more known. But it's really to do with sort of, you know, the way things are published. I mean, for example, William Bradford's manuscript vanishes, and is only, the actual manuscript of the book was taken to Boston or borrowed, and then stolen by the British during the Revolutionary Wars, and then it ended up in London, in West London, in the Bishop's Palace, and someone discovers it by accident. And it's only in 1855 that the whole book is published in its entirety. Sections have been published by people who had access to the manuscript, but the whole thing doesn't actually come out properly till the mid-19th century. So there are all sort of problems to do with sources and, right, and stuff. So that's one reason. I think if you sort of dive into the primary sources, then Edward Winslow very much comes to the fore as this ambassador to the Indians. And I was very intrigued that he'd worked for publishers in London, which specialised in travel literature, because that was a huge growth area in the early 17th century. So I think he was there when Pocahontas comes visiting and is treated in this very sort of grand way, and is treated as an emperor's daughter, which of course the British regarded her as being. And I think that made him excited, probably more excited than some of the other pilgrims.
So he sees Pocahontas in the court in London.
Well, he was there when she arrived, and this was a tremendous excitement for everybody. I mean, she was married to a Virginian planter. She was dressed in, she arrives wearing beautiful, sort of a beautiful court costume, in that you have this engraving of the portrait made of her at the time by Simon de Pass, when she's got a ruff on. I mean, her dress is as Elizabethan as Queen Elizabeth. And she sits, we have documents about her sitting on James I's right hand. And so it's a huge excitement for London that an Indian princess has arrived. I mean, Pocahontas is a star then and sort of a star now.
Right, exactly. And this is all
before
they...
Before he gets to Leiden.
Exactly. So in Leiden is in Holland, and then that's before the Mayflower sails for the New World. So his encounter with Pocahontas, his interest in American Indian culture is happening all before the founding of Plymouth.
Yeah, but also I would say that this isn't something just common to Edward Winslow. The educated world in London, the sort of reading public, and intellectuals are very, very curious about the New World. And John Donne, the poet, is preaching to the Virginia Company. And it's a sort of, it's the topic of interest of the day. And in the late 16th century, you have Montaigne writing essays about the American Indians. So the question is, who are they? Where have they come from? And then, as you know, there comes this sort of excitement. Could they be some of the lost tribes of Israel who were dispersed in the 8th century before the Common Era? So this is it's not just her arrival. This is part of huge interest in the American Indian tribes. Did they survive the flood? I mean, it's how do you fit these new people into a Eurocentric Christian chronology? For good or bad, that was their point of view in the 17th century in London.
Right.
So there is very great excitement at the thought of them, and it's really a very sort of exciting moment intellectually, and I think that feeds into Edward Winslow's approach to things, because he is really passionately interested in the American Indian tribes or the Native Americans.
Right, and you talk about him as an ethnographer, and that his writings from Plymouth and its environs are essentially ethnographies. And I want to come back to that in one second, but I just want to sort of summarize what we've been saying, which is that, Edward Winslow may may not be as well known because of just the history of publications and when and how and for what reasons stories are told over the last few hundred years.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, people today might just think, well, if I don't know who he is, especially in a story that apparently most Americans know, if I don't know who he is, then he must not be important, but which is completely not true because the way that these stories have been received are products of the history of publication, and which is intertwined with politics and religion and all sorts of things.
No, I agree. Yeah. I mean, for example, Governor John Carver is fantastically famous because of Thanksgiving, but actually he dies in the first year of Plymouth Colony. So he's not there. He's there for like 3 months. He dies in April. And yet he is probably the most famous pilgrim you can think of. And of course that's, you know, of course that's right. But actually he isn't there for the rest of the colony. That's to do with the sort of, I don't know how you describe the sort of luck of history or the sort of, he has become this tremendous figure because he was the person who sat talking, sort of making a peace treaty with the Wampanoags. But actually, he is out of the picture. I think that's, he is out of the picture very soon after that. I mean, he dies almost immediately.
Right. So he has this treaty with the Wampanoags. But then you talk about Edward's relationship with the Indians is much more complex and much longer.
Yes.
Edward survives. So now that you sort of mentioned this the history of Thanksgiving, how do you see Edward's role in Thanksgiving as it's developed, or the initial kind of coming together of these cultures?
Well, to defend Edward, which of course I want to do, he is the person who the first sort of document which is sort of used as sort of documentation of Thanksgiving, now that it's become such a very, very important coming together of peoples, is written by him in December 1621, and he does describe how Massasoit comes and feasts with them with 90 of his men, and he brings turkey and deer. And that is the first, although scholars quibble, can you say this is really right. Thanksgiving? What is it? Is it Harvest Festival? That is the first, that is a piece of a great feast between the American Indians and the Pilgrims of John enormous Carver. Excitement.
Right, as opposed to what John Carver is remembered for, which is actually the treaty?
Yes, I mean, he is the person, but it's all been sort of rolled into one.
Yes.
Because he is dead by December 1621. He has the meeting with Massasoit, but by the time we have the first Thanksgiving documented, he is no longer alive.
Right.
He dies out of sort of exhaustion and strain in the fields.
Right. And it's really Edward's sort of ongoing relationship with the Indians that involves not just the sharing of food, but of resources and knowledge that is rolled into this idea of Thanksgiving more broadly, which is why you're stressing and redeeming Edward's role in the long term.
Yes. I mean, so the Mayflower leaves, and very, very soon after that, John Carver collapses in the fields planting. And it's the beginning of a stroke. And then that's it. He's governor then. And then William Bradford becomes governor immediately afterwards. So William Bradford is governor from then on. I mean, obviously, Edward Winslow is periodically governor, but the big governor is William Bradford. So it is, I think Edward's very, Winslow's very special relationship with Massasoit is something which is sort of he develops. He wants to go and talk to them. All I was talking about with Governor Carver is that by accident of history, really, he has his figure we see sitting down rightly to make the peace treaty. But in fact, he isn't around for the first Thanksgiving.
Right. And I'm pressing on this point, not just because American listeners are always interested in Thanksgiving and its history, but actually what you're doing here is just showing how complicated all these historical milestones actually are in practice, and the very question of origin and how complicated that is, because Edward represents this give and take, this back and forth, much more complicated relationships
yes.
than are measured yes. in simply a treaty was drawn and we have a document. But what you're tracing
yes, in this book, exactly.
which is so powerful, is sort of the historical contingencies, the that sort of everyday, you know, personalities, encounters, and obstacles within the Plymouth community, but also amongst different American Indian communities around them, and how all of these are coming together in very complicated ways. And so we always want, you know, we want to know the beginning. We want to know how it all started. But what you're doing is showing how this idea of origins is actually this constant back and forth negotiation. So I'm wondering how you sort of balance the kind of the incorporation of all these little historical contingencies with this, you know, sort of mythological and inevitable story of America.
Yes, I think it's very difficult. I mean, I think if you are not American, in a way, you it's sort of, it's not easier, but you probably are less aware of the nuances. And obviously, if you're a historian, you want to sort of get under the myths to find out what people were really like, as opposed to the sort of myths. And I mean, that was part of the interest for me, you know, to see what they really were like. And particularly as there's been so much talk of the sort of genocidal tendencies of the English settlers, which, I mean, recent opinion academics now think there was much more symbiosis at the beginning right. Than in Francis Jennings' day. I was very intrigued by the sort of background to sort of going to America, what they were expecting, the fact that how did they learn the language so quickly? Well, a lot of the travel literature had words, you know, in the back, sort of lists of vocabulary, really from the earliest times, like William Strachey and obviously John Smith. So there was a sort of desire to communicate with the people that the people that they met, and sort of real interest in creating what Edward describes as a native church. I mean, for good or bad, that has bad connotations now, but what he means is a church amongst the people, the original people living in America, i.e. the American Indians or Native Americans.
I think most people will be sort of surprised by some of the ideas contemporaneous to that time, such as, and you mentioned it briefly, that they believed that the Indians were really white people, in a sense, or, you know, descendants from ancient biblical tribes.
Yes. I mean, John Smith, you know, elaborates and sort of says under their brown skins, they are white. And there were these sort of, it was definitely believed that they were all descended from Adam. So I don't think there was a sort of the early settlers, though I would say there really was not a sort of sense of racial division.
Right, right. Or that there was more of an interest in the difference between people and how Edward particularly wants to find the commonalities across those differences.
Yes, absolutely. And I was anxious to report on those back to investors in London and report on their religion, give their vocabulary, show that they were a moral and civilized people, which again was something which was sort of up for discussion. The Spanish Empire had these sort of public debates about sort of what was the nature of the peoples in the New World. And John Robinson, who their pastor and minister, who in fact is Governor Carver's brother-in-law, had these very strong beliefs that the English were not to be, as I quote, magistrates over the Indians. They were, you know, they were not to be they were not to be rulers of them, so that then when the English, warned by Massasoit, are forced to attack a sort of enemy American tribe, John Robinson writes a furious letter to the settlers saying, you know, you shouldn't have behaved like that. You shouldn't have shed their blood. So I think, you know, it's very, they're really sort of are very, very open-minded. Later on, they ask Roger Williams, who funds Rhode Island, to write a paper for them on who are the owners of the land, who are the original owners of the land. And we just have a reference to this in John Winthrop's journal. And John Winthrop didn't agree with this, but it is clear that Plymouth has asked Roger Williams to sort of give his view of who holds the land and who you buy it off. So it's very, you know, I think it's a very respectful, of the American Indians. And of course, Roger Williams, in one of the huge numbers of sort of letters from him, refers to the fact that when he was at Plymouth after he'd been expelled from Boston, when he preached in the meeting house in Plymouth, he was told he was regarded as a sachem for preaching, because a lot of the American Indians liked to listen to the talk in the meeting house. So you have a sense of a very symbiotic relationship in which people are coming in and out of Plymouth, conversing. And of course, we have Edward Winslow in Good News from New England discussing how he wanted to talk about religion to someone called Corbett, who's the head of the Pocasset tribe. So you feel there's a lot of, and also descriptions of how they travel with the American Indians 50 miles at a time, they sleep with them. There's a real feeling of community there to me as an English person. That's what it seemed to me.
Yeah, it is there. You know, as long as we have access to these documents and to these stories. I mean, Roger Williams, you know, is better known than Edward Winslow, but he's also sort of on the extreme end of his difference from the more orthodox religiosity of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. But it seems like Edward Winslow is interesting for all the ways we've been discussing, but also as a kind of mediator. I mean, he totally, I think, is akin to Roger Williams in some ways, but also he is a go-between with the Massachusetts Bay Colony leaders and then, of course, the investors back in England. And so he's, as you say, he's a lot of Winslow's documentation of Indians is to show, you know, how well the interaction is going with them to the investors back in London. And but these accounts, although, you know, they were circulating then, they weren't then for hundreds of years after. And in high school, for me, you know, we were assigned to read Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation, which I remember thinking, I'm like, oh, this is interesting, but kind of dry and boring. You know, it's like Of Plymouth Plantation is like sort of a record of, you know, kind of day to day, very sort of inward looking. How you describe Edward Winslow's accounts is they're more outward facing, they're more relational, you talk about ethnography, and it sort of connects us back to these more recent studies, this ethnohistory, sort of from the Indian's perspective and such like that, that his accounts back then match up with the most recent historiography about this moment written today.
Yes. I mean, I think that William Bradford's prose is sort of really beautiful and marvellous, but quite dense. And I also think that he was a mystical person, really, and he hated the idea of the community being scattered. He just wanted the little church, originally in Scrooby in Nottinghamshire, then in Leiden, finally in Plymouth, to remain this little covenanted community. He did not want everyone spreading out, making money, interacting with the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And I think he was emotionally he was emotionally against that. You know, he sees it's going to be the ruin of a church, as opposed to seeing it as sort of actually the beginning of New England. So he had a completely different outlook to Edward Winslow. And Edward and his brother, John Winslow, who died one of the richest merchants in New England, in fact, in Boston, because he leaves Plymouth, were merchants. That's not to say they weren't religious, but they were sort of dynamic merchants, really, with all that entails.
More cosmopolitan.
Not that William Bradford, more cosmopolitan, not that William Bradford did not invest in opportunities, because he did, but he was really committed to this, the idea of community and church. And you see this sort of yearning prose about how awful it is and this is going to be so sad for everybody. And then, although, of course, everyone has to move out.
Right. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about the place of Indians in this story as more complex through Edward Winslow's account. I want to move on to the place of women in this story. It's obviously most history that has survived is recorded or narrated by men. It's very much hard to find women's voices in print to the same degree that there are men's voices. But you do make a very concerted and powerful effort to bring in the, if not the voice of women, the presence of women. So, you know, there's a lot of conjecture about, well, perhaps she thought or she may have thought, but which is, you know, which is a standard mode of working for many historians today. But you also, what's actually more interesting to me is that you use the words depression and anxiety, I think, as to say that just look at their material circumstances, you know, the deaths, the coming and going of wealth, the changes in the churches and who's attending where, you know, the dangers of medical practices of the day. So just imagine all of this stuff going on around them. Now, you know, how would you feel? How would they feel? And so you kind of use that to ground the emotional circumstances. So can you talk a little bit about how you see women in the story, but also how you wrote them into the story in an important way?
Well, I'd written a biography of Charlotte Bronte many years ago, so I'm very interested, obviously, in women and sort of women's experience historically, and that they are, as you say, hidden voices or suppressed voices. So I was very curious about women on the Mayflower, particularly as there were two births. And it is very hard to get detail. Many years ago, Thatcher Ulrich wrote this wonderful article, which was called, it's always been summarized as, "Well-Behaved Women Do Not Make History." And that's so true. And it's very hard. You have to sort of really dive into things. You have to get into primary sources to think, is there a mention here, is there a mention there? Susanna Winslow is on the Mayflower, and again, it's very difficult to get material about her. I mean, really, it's sort of everything is sort of negative. You have to sort of wrench material out from sort of finding out that there's a letter actually from Edward Winslow to her uncle, who turns out to be connected to the Earl of Lincoln, probably was his steward. No other letters about Susanna Winslow have ever surfaced, and this said that could he tell Susanna's father that he has married her, they've lost a child, they've got another one on the way, and could he also pass back his address? So she's obviously not in contact with her father. So what I'm saying is, you take all these sort of these tiny clues and have to build up a sort of idea of someone leaving the family, not really being in contact, but in contact with someone who probably was a Puritan in the shape of her uncle, Robert Jackson, and then her new husband is in contact with him, to a sort of sense of a Puritan network. And but it's very, it's quite unsatisfactory in a way, and you have to speculate, and you also have to look at their physical situation. And I think that's where John Demos was so interesting, looking at sort of material relics of the pilgrims, and just think, what was it like? And it probably was okay for a bit, but then I think the arrival of Anne Hutchinson really changes the weather in a terrible way, because a lot of the Puritan women who came to New England, after all, were highly educated, because Puritans believed in the book, reading the Bible. But they often were vicars' daughters. They were very highly educated. They had their own opinions. And then this is Anne Hutchinson is someone with huge opinions, right. And then they're just closed down because they conflict with the male orthodoxy. And you can see why everybody is furious, because this is such a fragile little colony, Massachusetts Bay. It's only been going for 5 years, 6 years, and she starts criticizing everything and saying scholarship isn't necessary and hierarchies aren't necessary and it's what you feel. And she does say she's a prophetess, so you can see she is very anarchic. But I think John Winthrop, who writes these passionate letters to his many wives, obviously believes in female education, but he sort of turns against it. So there are all these letters in which he says, friends of his wives have become mentally ill because they've spent too much time reading and not enough time attending to their household duties. And I think it has a really bad effect on the position of women. And then you have this terrible sort of hysteria, sort of witchcraft hysteria. But it doesn't just start in 1692. It is a feature in New England history, alas, of women being accused of witchcraft. So that John Norton said that Anne Hibbins was really executed just for being cleverer than other people. And that is a very, very shocking, but to me, very true experience. Yeah. So I think it must have been very difficult being a woman in New England. Of course, Plymouth was more open-minded, I think, because they were separatists. But it still must have not exactly created a climate of fear, because I argue that, in fact, Penelope Pelham, who is the daughter-in-law of Edward Winslow, and her sister-in-law, Edward Winslow's daughter, are both feisty characters. But nevertheless, it's there up in the sky as a sort of a bit of a glass ceiling, shall we say.
Right.
There can be these accusations of witchcraft, really, for just being smart.
Yeah, I think that's exactly true. I mean, Anne Hutchinson, that story has been told a little bit more than most of the other women in the Plymouth Colony, because she is more extreme. But what that has done is sort of shown the hypocrisy and the fear of these men have towards outspoken women who are in many instances smarter than they are, actually.
Well, I think that Elizabeth Warren shows, because she was sort of allowed to sort of be an undertaker in Plymouth Colony, shows that actually, even if the glass ceiling is X, you can have people sort of doing other things within that. So Plymouth was more open-minded towards women, but I think it cannot but have been a sort of an oppressive factor in sort of female education.
Right. No, it's
or the way women were approached.
Right. Right. Exactly. Now, so which brings me back to John Demos's book, A Little Commonwealth, which is about the family in Plymouth Colony. Now, I have to say, I was when John taught his last history of colonial America class at Yale, I was a teaching fellow for him. So,
how wonderful!
So I know John, and I know that book, and I've taught it with him to undergrad.
Oh my goodness!
And one of the things that he does so well in that book and all his other work is, you know, it's to bring in the material culture of a place, the socioeconomic factors of a place, and then the sort of emotional narrative and the psychology as well.
Yeah.
And he's really focusing on on how these families survive in terms of the roles that women take and men take differently and similarly. And so, and a lot of the women in the story that you tell are doing, you know, it's too simple to say they're doing their duty. I mean, what they're contributing to is the growth and stability and strength of this colony, and which I just want to return briefly to the Laurel Ulrich quote, which, you know, people always say, quote, which is to say, well, you know, well-behaved women seldom make history. And it's always misunderstood to mean that, well, unless you're out there yelling something, you don't matter to history. But actually what she's saying is that there are these quote-unquote well-behaved women who are the very sort of engine of history. It's just that that they don't get the attention that they deserve.
Yes.
And so it's important to kind of understand it, right? That's what she's saying, and that's what John was interested in his book about A Little Commonwealth, and also what you're interested in terms of finding the place of these women in Edward Winslow's family specifically.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, to some extent, this has to be an imaginative reconstruction. So I just wondered whether Susanna Winslow, who had children, survived in a tough colony, how seriously could she take John Winthrop and co. and sort of thinking that, you know, the sort of fetal remains are a sign of wickedness. And I just did find it very interesting that actually the Winslows, by and large, do join an inconvenient but more liberal church. And to me, I don't know about Susanna, but certainly Josiah was a member of the Second Church at the Situate. But this made me think, maybe she just thinks actually Edward is a man who is sort of really given his very close friendship with John Winthrop, and I think he becomes very influenced by him and becomes a member of the Orthodox sort of group or party, that she, as a woman, I just sort of thought, oh well, I'm sure she was more independent minded than that, but maybe she didn't sort of discuss it, and all these things made me think. Obviously, not everything is told in not everything is written down, and that made me sort of curious about sort of the internal workings of the family. But I think the fact that Elizabeth Winslow does her daughter by Edward does challenge the really very alarming Jonathan Corwin and takes him to court to be able to educate her daughter, as he's trying to sort of make sure he is really the guardian. This suggested quite a sort of friendly atmosphere to women within the household, so that whereas Edward might be getting more and more what I would call right-wing in his old age, maybe that wasn't true of all the people within the Winslow household.
Well, I mean, it's obvious that they're observing Edward, the women in the Winslow household are observing Edward befriending John Winthrop and these other people in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and noticing that they operate a bit differently than we do here at Plymouth. So of course, the others witnessing this are going to be like, well, Edward was more like this before, and now he's a little bit different since he's made friends with those people up there, right? I mean, just like the basic emotional narrative is quite clear, I think, and it's right for you to sort of bring that out.
I was very interested in the fact that when there is this great thing, the Remonstrance, and the Orthodox Party under John Winthrop want to make it more difficult for people to join churches, whereas, of course, the sort of newer merchants want to have civil rights for people even if they're not members of the independent churches. But basically, Edward Winslow and William Bradford together stop a motion for freedom of religion coming to Plymouth Colony, because it was almost certain to get through because of most scholars think that Plymouth would have, there were enough deputies saying, yes, we don't mind, we're sort of independent minded. So it was a different milieu to to Massachusetts. And that's why William Bradford just refuses to allow the motion to be actually be put to the Plymouth government, because he and Edward Bass think if it's put.
Why would they not want it to pass if they are?
Because they want a New England, which is a godly New England, founded by these marvelous covenanted independent churches. They don't want this sort of godly New England to be polluted by people coming from New England and from Old England, who won't be part of this new place, but not joining the churches. I.e., they're not going to, you know, they want freedom of religion, and this is why Edward, of course, goes to Old England to try and stop people being able to appeal to London. To say, of course, you don't need to join the congregational churches if you want to have a vote. So they want a New England as they've sort of founded it, the people, you know, the Scrooby Church or Leyden Church is going to be a godly place in which everyone has to have to be members of the church. Although, of course, Plymouth didn't require church membership for the franchise. And in fact, Edward's stepson, Peregrine White, didn't become a member of any church till almost sort of just before he died. So it obviously was a much, much more liberal place.
Yeah, right. It's much more.
I mean, liberal is a wrong word, but right. Sort of more open-minded.
Right. More complicated than we think, certainly. Now, what's sort of interesting, though, is that, okay, so there, Edward and William Bradford are worried that their church and their vision of a community will be diluted by colonial settlers who are not interested in creating the communities within these churches. So they see that their friends up in Massachusetts Bay Colony are also interested in keeping their communities pure in this regard. However, it sort of backfires, right, in the sense that then these alliances now that are forming between the colonists across the different colonies are actually creating, say, the Indians as more of an enemy. So like what begins to happen, and your book sort of traces, is that there's this sort of celebratory first part of the story with so much potential. And then as more and more colonists come over and there's more English people to manage, and Edward aligns himself for reasons of power and economics with the people in Massachusetts Bay Colony, that then this is forming this sort of behemoth of what will become a kind of intolerance towards even those Indians that Edward found a potential to become a part of some kind of community. His alliance with the Massachusetts Bay kind of helps ensure that there's a church here at the base, but also it's kind of going to backfire as generations go on and there's more of a separation between the English and the Indians.
Well, that was my opinion. And I think that in fairness, to do justice to the settlers, the people coming from England, of course, the Indian tribes do become very, you know, after the Pequot War, certainly the word has gone out. They do begin to become very suspicious of the English, with reason.
Right.
So probably they are more hostile. On the other hand, this is all, in my view, poked by the Massachusetts Bay Colony not really knowing enough about the people they're living with as opposed to Plymouth.
Right.
And yes, I think there is, you know, academics say there is this real problem in that the Anne Hutchinson affair has sort of has polluted this glorious wilderness. Are the Indians part of Satan being in the wilderness? The clergy start looking at the Indian tribes in a different way, and start being much more hard and fast about what they believe, in great contrast to the open-mindedness of Plymouth. I mean, obviously, some English colonists are not like that, but the sort of the governing mood is a sort of hostility. And then, of course, it's not helped really by Samuel Gorton taking the part of the Narragansetts,
right.
And stirring it up. But the Narragansetts leader has been executed. So I think it really, the sort of the very lovely symbiosis does start to degenerate. And it's very sad because John Winthrop's diary mentions, you know, in one of his entries is of Edward Winslow. He sort of saw Edward Winslow and his old ally, Osa Meakin, which is the other name for Massasoit. As you know, Indians had many names.
Mm-hmm.
How he's sort of taken home by his old ally, and then Massasoit plays a trick on him. And John Winthrop at the beginning is obviously sort of marveling at the new world, and then because of the English colonists moving into Connecticut and displacing the Indian tribes there, and already the Narragansetts have got very jumpy because they'd escaped the plague of the 1616 plague, which had wiped out a lot of Massasoit people. But in 1633, it starts to wipe them out. And these terrible tensions start to arise so that everyone is what you might call trigger happy.
Right.
And then it sort of goes downhill from there. And, you know, Alfred A. Cave said that the Peacock War, I think it was him, that it's a small war which casts a very big, or maybe an Alden Vaughan. Anyway, it's a very small war which casts an enormous shadow. And I would totally agree. I think then you get this sort of terrible unraveling of the relationship between the English and Indians. And some people think that William Wood is far too sort of optimistic about he comes in 1633 and writes in this ecstatic way about Massachusetts Bay Colony, but I disagree. I mean, I think it sort of ties in with what Edward Winslow has been saying, and that there is this sort of, you know, wonderful relationship between the two. But after 1637, then it all starts to go downhill.
I mean, it's one of the lessons I take from that, and the way you tell it is that, you know, the larger the community of settlers becomes, the harder it is to maintain that symbiosis with the other communities that are there.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're at a smaller scale, different communities like Plymouth and different individuals can interface in much more nuanced ways with people who are different from them.
Yes,
it's just harder to find a way to combine, you know, in any sort of interesting.
I agree, and I think that the fact is that, rather like Edward Winslow, Roger Williams was also really passionately interested in the American Indians. So, you know, there were all these letters saying, I just wanted to be in their smoky holes and understand their souls and not see any English. And then he is given shelter against Massachusetts Bay by Massasoit and then by the Narragansetts. And he, you know, his land at Providence is actually measured out by this famous chief, Canonicus, and Canonicus is buried in a gift of cloth from Roger Williams. And there is this wonderful description of how Canonicus is laid to rest as reverently as John Winthrop. This is Roger Williams speaking. And, you know, there's such an appreciation there because they gave him shelter. And he also writes letters when the English start deciding that the American Indians should be living in praying towns, wearing English or European style clothing. He writes a letter sort of saying, you know, these people have given us shelter when we had enemies in our homeland. Surely they deserve better than to be treated like this, because various people are saying, please don't put us in English towns. So I agree. There's a kind of a sort of the personal is very important here. And then if you don't have personal interaction, obviously people, you know, become less sort of interested in one another.
Yeah, we just have a few more minutes left, but I wanted to bring in quickly then Josiah, who is Edward's son.
Yes.
And Josiah very much is a leader during when the wars between the Indians and the colonists kind of get out of hand. So in some ways, the structure of the book, you know, its first half is about Edward the father, and then the second half is about Josiah the son and how alliances go awry. And so can you talk a little bit about Josiah's place in the story and how his relationship with his father factors into this?
Well, I was very curious in that William Hubbard, the clergyman, wrote an account of a history of New England, and then he wrote the history of the Indian Wars, very contemporary. And in two or three versions, he notes the extreme animosity of Wamsutta or King Philip towards Josiah. And Josiah himself, in a letter, says, "I hear that Philip is sort of after me." And this, to me, was of great interest. You know, why? You know, there are lots of people living in Plymouth. Why should Philip particularly focus on Josiah? And I discovered that Josiah had become much more involved in trade, like his father, with Boston. He had a sort of import-export business. He also had a very aristocratic English-American Bostonian wife, Penelope Pelham. And he obviously visited England quite a lot, and also because he supervised Herbert Pelham, the first treasurer of Harvard's son, who was Penelope's half-brother, who came back to inherit Herbert Pelham's land in New England. And I think he didn't have that connection. And everyone, you know, it's well known, scholars say that in the second generation of settlers, they have noticed this fear of what's known as creolization, a sort of fear of losing your original sort of where you're coming from, your original sort of civilization. And is it that, like many other people, Josiah could not have a sort of interest in the Indians because he feared he was growing too like them? No, obviously not. Well, but was he losing his sort of Englishness? And to me, it was very curious that he sees the Indians as very insolent and arrogant, whereas of course the first generation of settlers think they're noble and wonderful, and they like the sort of arrogance which they see as noble. So it's like the whole thing has turned 360 degrees. And I think we don't know what his relationship with his father was. But after all, his father had left. He had to assume a lot of responsibilities in Plymouth. But I think it's not really. I think that Edward Winslow was obviously a big figure in the life of the Poconokets. And I think that maybe, you know, there's a sort of resentment there that this was meant to be their father's friend, and then sort of now the son is not a friend at all. And I think, you know, why would William Hubbard invent the sort of particular malice of King Philip Wamsutta towards Josiah Winslow? I mean, he was no worse than everyone else, but they had become very suspicious. And rightly so, clearly, some time before the war actually breaks out, King Philip has come to the conclusion that, you know, it's now or never. And particularly as his father very foolishly is selling more and more land. And, you know, Josiah obviously has a sort of attitude to land which is not that of Roger Williams. And I think this is all tremendously hard to combat. I think the tragic thing about Philip is he wanted to modernize. I mean, a lot of the Indian tribes wanted European technology, and Philip actually asked John Eliot to send someone to teach his people to read. So it's not that he is turning his back on a sort of different, you know, sort of possibly advantageous culture, but he realizes that actually no one is really thinking of them in the way the Wampanoags in the way that John Robinson had been, that these are their own rulers, their own land, and that eventually they are just going to take over. So I think a lot of things come into play. I think the execution of Miantonimo was a really terrible, terrible moment, and the young chief of the Narragansetts. And I think that was sort of a sort of sacrilege, really. I mean, this was a local royal family, and you know, he was sacrificed without really a backward thought. And I think that just made everyone feel completely threatened, that the Indian tribes tended to sort of be quite benevolent towards the English at first, and then they feel they're not being treated with the respect that they, as the original people, you know, imagine.
Right. And so,
what I found very, very something I found really interesting was that quite soon, both Narragansett and indeed King Philip find out that actually the real sort of equivalent to themselves is the Stuart royal family in England, and because they're hereditary royal people, and all these other people are just elected people. They are not, and so that's why you have these extraordinary contemporary accounts. It's not invented, of Philip demanding, you know, he's not going to be tried by anyone other than his brother, Charles the First.
Right, right. So he's aligning with the king back in England and saying, "Who are you, minions?
Yes,
over here.
Yeah,
bring me to your king.
Exactly.
I'm higher, more powerful than you are."
Yeah. So I find that, even though it's probably Samuel Gorton stirring it all up, clearly they were royal families, and just amazed at the sort of new system of things. So I think Josiah Winslow, it's generational, but I think he is also quite an arrogant man who has a sort of sense of caste which probably wasn't present in his father.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it all comes down to power and, you know, shifting power dynamics and the need for it and the desire for it, the more you have it. And it's interesting to think about how Josiah's treatment of the Indians, seeing them as too arrogant and dismissing them, is a kind of negotiation he's having with his father too.
Maybe
through the Indians. And I only say that because so much of our treatment of people who are quote unquote other than us is really a reflection of our own, you know, questions and problems and anxieties about ourselves, you know, but we're just using.
Yes. No, I think
to work through. So this seems to be
one
more example in the long history of the world of that dynamic.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think that's, true. I mean, it's very interesting that actually Josiah really obviously doesn't have any problems with sort of writing groveling letters to Charles II, whereas, of course, his father and co. were really sort of quite strong Republicans in the sense that they didn't see kings as particularly special. I mean, they were very sort of a new people, really, the Plymouth settlers, or indeed the Massachusetts Bay settlers.
Well, we have to end now.
Right.
But we could obviously keep talking about this endlessly fascinating and detailed history that you bring to new life. And a fun fact I just wanted to add was that actually my partner is Conrad Winslow, is descended from the Mayflower Winslow.
Oh, how amazing.
I know, it just so happened.
So he must be connected to Robert Lowell.
We have to take a close look at the family tree to see where all the connections are coming down. Winslows are alive and well, and Conrad is a
composer. He's really called Winslow.
Yes, last name.
How wonderful!
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh well, please give him my best.
I will, and of course. But this, as you show, the Winslow story is the story of America in so many ways. Again, we have been talking to Rebecca Fraser, and her new book, just out from St. Martin's Press, is called "The Mayflower: The Families, the Voyage, and the Founding of America." Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.